This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In our last podcast, I talked to economists, some of whom think that Donald Trump has got the right idea when it comes to his policies on tax, job creation and investment. But it turned out that even Trump's supporters are worried about one aspect of his economic policy, trade. So it's to that subject that this episode is devoted. I hope you enjoy it.
We will never, ever sign bad trade deals. America first again. America first.
During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump made trade the centerpiece.
We've made other countries rich, while the wealth, strength, and confidence of our country has dissipated over the horizon. One by one, the factories shuttered and left our shores with not even a thought about the millions and millions of American workers that were left behind.
He's promised to protect American workers from bad trade deals that mean previously American-made goods being manufactured in countries like Mexico, where labor is cheap.
We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies and destroying our jobs.
He says his policies will reopen factories, bring jobs back to the United States, and lead to great prosperity and strength. On polling day, millions of voters, particularly in America's Midwest, where manufacturing jobs have been in steady decline, went for it. But can President Trump deliver on his promise to use trade deals to bring back American jobs from overseas? And what will America first mean for the rest of the world, including Britain? First, a primer. David Smith, economics editor for the Sunday Times, explains what we know so far about Trump and trade.
We know that many of the sentiments that Donald Trump presented during his campaign were very protectionist in nature. In other words, he's interested in making it more difficult for other countries to export to America and make it easier for American companies to export to the rest of the world.
We will follow two simple rules: buy American and hire American.
If you think about world trade, there were two big deals in progress, one of which was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the other one was the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. One, obviously, with Pacific countries, predominantly Asia, and the other with Europe. Now, the European one was pretty much dead before the presidential election. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the deal with Asia, was still alive, but Donald Trump announced very quickly that he would be pulling out of that one. The other main thing in terms of specific deals is the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. NAFTA is composed of three countries, Mexico, the United States and Canada. He hasn't said he will pull out of it, but he said he'll renegotiate that and in particular impose tariff barriers, in other words, a border tax on imports from Mexico.
Our horrible trade agreements with China and many others will be totally renegotiated. That includes renegotiating NAFTA to get a much better deal for America, and we'll walk away if we don't get that kind of a deal.
Essentially, there are two types of trade restrictions or protectionism. There are tariff and non-tariff barriers. Now, the great progress that was made in the post-war era was to bring down tariffs very aggressively over a number of years, to the point where tariffs between industrial countries, in other words, the tax that is charged by an importing country on another country's goods, were brought down to pretty low levels. Now, Donald Trump has threatened to turn that back, and in particular has mentioned two countries, China and Mexico, and has talked about tariffs of between 35 and 45%.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
The protectionism that we associate with Donald Trump's rhetoric comes under the heading of America first. We saw something similar in the 1920s and 1930s, the belief that the more isolationist America was, the better off it would be. If you close yourself off to the world, that is a way to generate prosperity. And I think all modern economic thinking would say that that is not the case, that the countries benefit from trading with one another. The Trump arguments don't really see that. They see the world trade system essentially working to the disadvantage of America. I think this is important in a historical context, because if one thinks about the dawn of the Great Depression, and the reason the Great Depression was worse in America than in much of the rest of the world, was that America signed into law in 1930 something called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, which was a big increase in tariff barriers to try and protect American industry. And the result was that those years were much worse for America.
Protection will lead to great prosperity and strength. I will fight for you with every breath in my body, and I will never, ever let you down.
Throughout the post-war period, when you've had other parts of the world, other countries, you know, China and India among them, which have been inherently protectionist in their approach, they've been dragged along, they've been brought into free trade, into the World Trade Organization, by the attitude of, in particular, America. If you lose that, then I think that is a great risk to the world economy. And it's a great risk in particular now, because in the years since the global financial crisis, world trade has been underperforming, and there has been a quiet increase in protectionism. To impose on that an explicitly protectionist president, I think, is very bad for the world economy and very bad for the outlook for global trade, for free trade in general.
David Smith from the Sunday Times. Those of you who listened to last week's programme on Trump's domestic economic policies will have heard Arthur Laffer, an almost legendary economist and top advisor to President Reagan. He expected great things from Trumponomics, predicting a massive boom in economic growth driven by promised deregulation and tax cuts. However, he had one major concern.
I'd be worried about trade. I'm a total free trader. I always have been, and I think the U.S. should be an extraordinarily pro-growth free trade nation.
Now, what he actually said in his inauguration speech was, hire American, buy American. That's not really a kind of big free trade position.
No, it's not. Excuse me. Let me just say this about Trump. If you listen to Trump over the years, again, if you take him literally, you're going to find all sorts of contradictions in what he's saying. If you take the sort of the basket of what he says and not any one sentence as being the, I think if it comes out, makes a lot of sense. But taking him literally, you'll find contradictions. You'll find things like that don't make much sense to me either.
But don't you think he's more or less promised the people in the Rust Belt states that narrowly voted for him but did vote for him, in effect, that they won't suffer competition from, frankly, competitive industries abroad?
I don't think that's exactly what he said. Now, I listened to it all very carefully, and the way I interpreted what he said is we will make it much more attractive here by cutting the corporate tax rate, by having some of the state subsidies and incentive programs in there. And by deregulation and making it more worthwhile and more profitable to produce, he did talk about putting on trade barriers. That's very true. And I don't know whether that was part of his bluffing or whether it was actually he intends to do it. And I just hope he doesn't intend to do it, to be honest with you.
So on the one hand, President Trump says free trade has killed off American jobs and dampened growth. On the other hand, even one of his most ardent supporters says he's got it wrong and should cut out the talk of tariffs and trade war. What should we make of it? To help me figure it out, Diana Furchgott-Roth, currently a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, who worked on Donald Trump's campaign and transition team. She was on the programme last week, expressing huge enthusiasm and optimism for Trumponomics, and she's in our Washington studio. I'm joined here in London by another Trump-supporting economist, Professor Ted Malloch. The Financial Times has accused him of overspinning a few tales in his autobiography, but what's not in doubt is that he's a Trump supporter and a professor at Henley Business School in Reading. Many in the European Parliament fear he will become President Trump's ambassador to the EU. And also with me is Monique Ibel, an economist at the National Institute for Economic and Social Research, NISA, who originally comes from the Rust Belt state of Michigan. And Monique Ibel, if I can actually begin with you, why have governments like the US and the UK generally pursued freer global trade since World War II? I mean, what in theory is the benefit of it?
Well, in theory, freer trade is win-win for both sides. It allows countries to do what they do best. It allows them to specialize in the things that they can make the most profits at and outsource the stuff that they're not very good at doing to places that can do it better, meaning cheaper imports. That's the idea behind free trade. Everyone does what they can do best, and then we all end up producing as much as possible, and we all end up winning.
Diana Furchgott-Roth, you were very enthusiastic about President Trump's plans to cut, tax and deregulate in the last programme, and so enthusiastic that you worked on his campaign and his transition team. But what's your thinking about his position on trade?
One thing he wants to do is see if he can enforce existing trade agreements more fairly. So, for example, you can go to China, you can go to Beijing, and you can see a fake Apple shop there, which is so realistic that even employees think they are working for Apple. You can find pirated videos on the streets. Now, if China can whisk away a Hong Kong bookseller because he's selling material that they don't like, they can certainly close down these false shops in Beijing, but they don't do that.
But he went much further than that, didn't he? Because, for instance, in a speech on jobs, he said globalization has made the financial elite very wealthy, but it has left millions of our workers with nothing but poverty and heartache. Now, in that, he wasn't really addressing whether or not China had allowed knockoff and sort of fake Lacoste and Apple even at whatever level. He seemed to be saying these guys have come in and sold products to us that we used to make ourselves at less than we can make them for.
Yes, he was definitely saying that. It's unclear exactly what he means by that. He could be using it as a threat, or he could be serious.
Now, let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that this America, Buy America, Hire America is not just aimed at China, but is actually a more general approach to trade and to trade partnerships. And let's suppose he is serious about it, because people have said in the past, well, he's not serious, he's not going to do X, Y, and Z. And by and large, we may think the record of the first few weeks is that he is actually doing the things that he said and so on. What would you think of that?
Well, it would certainly raise prices for many people within the United States, many people who voted for him. And so they would end up being worse off rather than better off. But trade, as Monique explained it, when everybody does what they do best, can sometimes result in a group of people being disenfranchised. So you have people who worked in manufacturing jobs, for example, especially those in their 50s, who it's very difficult to retrain, and they might not see the benefits of the new trade that other people see. So it's a very complicated situation. So on the one hand, more has to be done to compensate the losers. And on the other hand, putting in place tariffs does mean that these individuals who don't have jobs now are going to see higher prices at the Walmarts, higher prices for fruits that come in from Mexico, for example, and that can be a very big disadvantage.
So in your view, should you interfere with trade deals in the market in order to compensate the losers?
In theory, the benefits from the winners are supposed to go to the losers. But in fact, the distributional effects can be very, very varied. So you find individuals employed in, for example, what we sometimes call the Rust Belt industries here, former steel manufacturing plants, find themselves very much worse off. And we need to acknowledge that that's a problem.
But you don't envisage in that, I mean, if you were, let's say, in charge, you don't envisage in that a Buy America, Hire America policy as the way of dealing with that problem?
Personally, I don't think that it will solve that problem. But yes, he has talked about it. But if it involves higher prices on goods coming into the States, then it's not clear that these people will end up being better off. On the other hand, if the threats of tariffs can be used to break down barriers in China and other countries so that they accept more American investment, more American exports, then that could be very beneficial.
Ted Maddox, like Dinah, you're a big Trump supporter. In fact, you've been one of his most vocal supporters in the media in recent weeks. What do you think about this?
Well, honestly, I think that our elites in both political parties on both sides of the political spectrum have been lying about this and exaggerating the benefits of globalization for decades. Like free trade, it's really, as we've been discussing, a mixed bag. Like any equation, there are inevitably winners and losers. And unfortunately, the losers have been not just Americans, but particularly the middle class who work in manufacturing and reside in the Rust Belt. So free trade, and I am an economist, you see, is very nice as it appears in theory and in economics textbooks, but it does not benefit everyone. So the U.S. has lost many of its jobs over the last 15 years. I mean, this is well documented. I think over 6 million real workers gone. Last year, the U.S. ran a $365 billion merchandise trade deficit with China alone, which translates to about 2.5 million jobs lost. So the question is, how do you get those jobs back? How do you get reciprocity in the system? How do you get countries to play by the rules which were set up originally by the World Trade Organization? How do we keep more jobs at home? How do we get other countries to open up? And do we have to at least threaten to close our markets down in order to do that? President Trump's point is that America has been stupid for too long. So now we need to get smart. Global trade is not a zero-sum game, and we have to have a comprehensive plan to uphold the promise that he has made to the American voters.
Can I ask you just a bit about what you call the lying elites, which is quite a strong phrase and so on? Would you regard Margaret Thatcher's commitment and the promise about the benefits of free trade as being part of the lying elite, for instance? I don't want to personalise it, but I mean, just so that the British audience can understand what we're talking
there's
about.
There's no need to personalise it, or certainly to take it back to some earlier decade. I'm referring to our own political elites in the United States, with whom I've worked for years. I think the same could be said in various European settings, and including in Britain. So many people in the Republican Party have made a strong case for free trade without really coming to grips with the fact that sometimes the tables have been tilted against us,
which is
this notion then of fair trade, which is, of course, what Donald Trump is arguing.
Monica Bell, what do you make of what you've heard?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between manufacturing and services. So I'm always a bit puzzled that when people talk about bringing jobs back to America, what they mean is bringing manufacturing jobs back to America. And there, I think a lot of people have this nostalgia for the 60s and 70s when there were high-wage, fairly low-skilled manufacturing jobs in the U.S. I think we need to understand that that is done, that is over. We need to understand...
Why is it done? Why is it over?
Because we cannot compete at low-value-added... We cannot sustain high wages for American workers with low-tech, low-value-added work. Wages need to be earned. And those wages get earned by creating value. And being in a position to create value is about having the right technology and having the right skills.
But there manufacturing are certain... itself is changing. We're moving to advanced manufacturing.
Well, those are the kinds of manufacturing.
AI, robotization, blockchain, all the...
That's the kind of manufacturing that we should be seeking and which we can retain. The other thing is that services, it is true that services trade is not as free as goods trade. This is a problem for the U.S. The U.S. does need to try to make inroads in getting better deals on services. This is what we're good at. This is one of the things that we should be able to exploit. And it's probably the main reason, I would argue, why we have such large trade deficits overall. Countries like the U.S., like the U.K., have big trade deficits in goods, but either much smaller deficits or even surpluses in services. And that gets back to China, right? Yes, we need better intellectual property enforcement. We need better market access for our banks, for our filmmakers, for our lawyers and our accountants and our engineers. But that requires a lot of long, subtle kinds of negotiations about common standards.
Ted Malik, is that sufficient in your view? Now, the idea of protection, I mean, actually, Donald Trump even quoted Abraham Lincoln in support of protection, which one might think was in a kind of slightly previous era of world trade. And the suggestion really was that we will get your jobs back and we will protect your jobs from foreign competition. Do you think that politically that was a significant part of his appeal? In other words, does quite a lot of his success or failure rest on his ability to convince the people who voted for him that he actually will do and has done that?
Well, I think there's no question that President Trump has set a high hurdle for himself. I mean, it's the overarching theme of his entire presidency, namely to make America great again. And part of that is to make the economy more robust in terms of economic growth, which obviously implies bringing jobs back.
Now, I'm not an economist, but I've absorbed the kind of economics discussions that have gone on during my adult lifetime. And if I were channeling not just Margaret Thatcher, but a number of other people, what I would come back to you with is I would say, if you protect American industry, don't you effectively compensate inefficiency? Or have I got something badly wrong here?
No, I think you have the theory correct. It's just that in reality, there are costs to pay and people who suffer. So you have to actually live in a political world that's not just a textbook world of economics. So I believe that Trump, you know, will clearly try to block some companies from shifting their production overseas by taxing them identically at home and abroad, by abolishing the foreign tax credit. And by, as he's already done, and I think you're going to see this very significantly, jawboning them, as he's done with Ford and Carrier.
Can you tell me a bit more about jawboning?
That means calling up the CEO and saying, look, if you don't keep your production in Indiana, there's going to be some costs. And we're seeing...
Oh, you mean threatening?
I guess that's another word for it, isn't it? So the term jawboning has a long history, at least in American political life, where you basically talk people into doing them by using a carrot or a stick. You don't actually have to use either, but you can convince them to do things. And I think this is certainly what he's doing. I mean, in the case of Carrier, you know, saving a certain number of thousand jobs or whatever.
Monique Bell.
Well, I'd like to speak as someone who's actually from the Rust Belt for a moment. You know, even if we bring back jobs to America, it's not clear they're going to the places where people feel left behind. And the other thing is, people I went to high school with, at least a third, probably a half, have left Saginaw. They have gone out. They have sought opportunities in other parts of the country that were growing. The people who stayed and who are thriving are those who reskilled, who acquired the skills that were necessary to get jobs in the high-tech bits of manufacturing that stayed. So I think it's a bit unusual to me to hear Republicans talking about the left behind as someone that needs to be sort of cosseted and welfare stated, rather than thinking about understanding that maybe those jobs aren't coming back to Michigan we might need to ask people to move to the places where those jobs might end up going.
So, Ted Malik, you're the dangerous socialist here.
I've never been accused of that, so please continue. No.
Diana Feshkott-Roth, put your futuristic cap on or look into your crystal ball, whatever. What do you think he will actually do, and what do you think will actually happen on trade as a result?
Well, I can forecast the past. The future I have more trouble with. But I think that it's clear that any economic growth is going to come from the tax and regulatory components. And it's possible that the growth that this generates is going to mute quite a lot of the discontent that we're hearing from people who now are not only unemployed, but also completely out of the labour force who want to come back.
So he won't need to do it, is your argument?
And that he won't need to do it. If there is a situation where tariffs are imposed, then I do see quite a lot of complaints from people who voted for him if the prices of their imports go up.
So what I want to know, Ted Malik, is what do you think America First and this kind of idea of trade preference at home is going to mean for the rest of the world? And if we could leave China out of it for a bit, we've got the China point, but for everybody else, maybe leave Mexico out too and concentrate on the rest of the world.
The rest of the world, yeah. Well, the economic reality, I think, that we've been talking about is that tariffs don't usually work. I don't think there will be a Trump war on trade, that some of this is bluster, some of it is jawboning, some of it is actually a choice to move into bilateral relationships as opposed to multilateral relationships. He just had a summit, of course, with Prime Minister May. They talked about a potential bilateral trade relationship with the UK coming out of the special relationship. He prefers those kinds of bilateral.
But that means you've got to, I mean, say that the EU, if you really wanted to do that, you would have to negotiate with 27 countries and not with one entity. That's pretty tricky, isn't it? I mean,
for the time being.
For the time being, you've got your sinister look on. The EU will only last so long, seems to be what you're saying.
I didn't say that. I think you put words in my mouth.
Brexit. Talking to 20, yeah. But that would still mean talking, if that were to happen, to 27 separate states. So, so could you explain what the advantage is of having 27 separate trade negotiations rather than just the one in that instance?
Well, I think that America, and certainly President Trump, would feel that America could have a stronger relationship, a better relationship. It's almost like buying a suit off the rack, if you will, and buying a bespoke, to use your term, a custom-made suit, that you could have a better deal on a one-by-one bilateral relationship than you can have in a multiplicity.
If you're the bigger partner, yes, but if you're the smaller partner...
Ah, so you just caught on, didn't you?
Tell me.
Well, you said it. If you're the bigger partner, you would prefer to have the negotiations with all these smaller partners rather than with a group of big partners.
And if you're the smaller country?
We'll see.
No, come on. You can see where that one goes. Presumably, if you're the smaller country, you'd prefer to be teamed up with the other countries, wouldn't you, for the very same reasons?
So there are different interests.
Saying Brexit was a big mistake for us in terms of Trump. That's the logic of what you've just said.
Well, we'll have to see with Brexit what deal can be struck between the UK and the existing European Union. If it takes this other path and goes global, then it would have a multiplicity of bilateral relationships, possibly with even more countries than it has in its European relationship.
That's all on Trump and trade for this episode of The Briefing Room. I'd like to thank my guests, David Smith, Arthur Laver, Diana Feshkott-Roth, Ted Malik and Monique Bell. Now, before we go, I want to follow up on an email we had about last week's episode about Donald Trump's domestic economic policies, creating jobs, cutting taxes and investing in infrastructure. The late President Reagan's economic advisor, Arthur Laffer, who you heard in this podcast, appeared in that episode too, explaining why he believes that lowering taxes will create jobs.
If you have two locations, A and B, if you raise taxes in B and you lower taxes in A, producers and manufacturers are going to move from B to A.
Sounds logical, but perhaps things are not so simple. Prem Olsen wrote to us from Lucca in Italy to say he'd heard Laffer's theories pulled apart on a respected US podcast about economics.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Robert Smith.
I'm Zoe Chase. Today, a Republican governor lives the dream, cuts taxes dramatically in his state.
We're a state in transition from a high-tax state to a low-tax state.
He promises good times ahead, and the good times do not come.
And people, even the Republicans, get really mad.
The program told the story of an economic policy love-in between Arthur Laffer and a Republican governor in Kansas. But the application of Laffer's ideas didn't coincide with a boom. The cash freed up by tax cuts to small businesses wasn't necessarily spent on investment. And listeners were told of a town which lost its only school when there wasn't enough public money to keep it going. And in the state overall, job growth was sluggish compared to neighbouring states. So how do the tax-cutting free marketeers explain that? Joining me from Washington, D.C. to explain this apparent failure of Lafferism in practice is Ryan Bourne from the think tank, the Cato Institute. Ryan, thanks very much for coming on to do this.
Good to be with you. Hi.
First, remind us a little bit about Laffer's theory and his famous Laffer curve.
Well, years ago, Laffer was famous for drawing on a napkin quite an intuitive curve, which in essence said that if you tax at a rate of 0%, you get zero revenue. And if you tax at a rate of 100%, then you'll also get zero revenue because nobody would have any incentive to work. So the basic idea behind this basic conceptual idea, which actually had been articulated by other economists such as John Maynard Keynes in the past, was that between those two extremes, there was a revenue maximising rate at which a tax rate would raise the most revenue for government. So that would suggest that actually, theoretically, there would be instances where tax rates were too high, and if you cut the tax rate, you could actually get more revenue for the government.
That seems perfectly sensible to me, and the question is just being at what point that would occur. But tell us a bit more about how Laffer's theories were applied in Kansas.
What in essence happened in Kansas was the governor, Sam Brownback, cut the income tax rates to 4.9%, the top one, from 6.45%, and lowered all other income tax rates to 3%. He also exempted all small businesses from income tax altogether. Now, originally, he'd proposed that that would be offset somewhat by a planned sales tax hike and eliminating lots of other deductions. But, of course, when these when the bill for the budget was going through the House and the Senate in Kansas, a lot of those pay-for features of the program were written out of the law. So eventually he signed in a law which actually cut the taxes but didn't eliminate the deductions or in the way that would have enabled the scheme to be revenue neutral.
So let me get make sure I understand it. There was actually going to be a compensating tax for the cut in income tax, which was the sales tax, which was going to help in some way raise some revenue that you might lose through the loss in income tax.
Yeah, I mean, overall, it was still due to be a tax revenue cut, but he was going to eliminate lots of these deductions that you have in the tax code, things like mortgage interest deduction and certain tax credits, going to make those less generous, such that you at least compensated for some of the revenue lost through the tax cuts. Now, as it happened, a lot of those features then got written out of the law.
Because other people didn't like them.
That's right. A lot of senators who didn't like his overall package. But then what the governor did was just sign the law anyway as it stood. And that, of course, meant less revenue for the state. And without compensating spending cuts elsewhere, of course, that led to a bit of a hole in the budget.
So in other words, the governor was a dumb applier of Laffer's theories.
I don't know if it was a dumb applier. I mean, I would suggest that actually that there's lots of evidence out there and there's been lots of work by Carol Mertens at Cornell University that show that tax cuts can have a big positive impact on economic growth and job creation. But you have to, in the long term, pay for that by commensurate spending reductions. And he clearly didn't do that. Now, the overall effects of the tax cut, I think, are mixed. And I think the jury stood out in terms of their long-term effects. There was some evidence that if you look at the Missouri-Kansas border, that there were movement of workers from Missouri to Kansas. But there are lots of confounding factors here. You know, overall, the Midwest has had very low population growth. It's not the most economically vibrant area of the country. And taxes aren't everything. There are lots of other factors which people take into consideration when determining where to live and where to invest.
Like whether or not you have a good school, for instance.
That might be one thing. Obviously, this wasn't ideal, the fact that there was a scramble to actually balance the budget, because remember, states have balanced budget rules, unlike the federal government, so they have to balance their budgets pretty quickly. So that meant that spending did have to be cut in a pretty arbitrary way. Clearly, that wasn't ideal. But the central concept, the idea that you make a state more attractive by having lower marginal tax rates, and that has a positive effect on incentives, I don't think you'd find many economists who challenge that to a high degree.
So the governor gets his tax cut through, but doesn't get his compensatory tax increase on sales tax through. That's not so popular. So, Ron, do you think there's a kind of lesson there in the politics of economics for Donald Trump?
Well, I think what's certainly clear with US economic policy is that Donald Trump's going to have to give and take a bit with his Congress. I think there probably is a lesson there. Donald Trump very much wants to get a huge infrastructure bill through the House and through the Senate. And lots of Republicans historically have been deficit hawks, or at least have talked a good game of being deficit hawks over the past 4 or 5 years. So it'll be interesting as we go forward to see whether Donald Trump is actually able to strike, you know, he says he's a great deal maker, whether he's able to strike a type of deal with the Senate Republicans and House Republicans to get his infrastructure bill through at the same time as offering them some meat on perhaps tax cuts or trade policy. So I think there probably is a lesson there, which is that the US government has lots of checks and balances at all levels. And if you're going to get decent economic policy through, you've got to take into consideration those checks and balances.
Ryan, maybe since you're going to be in the States for a while, as we progress through what's called Trumponomics, you'll come back and talk to us again about how it's going.
No, I'd love to, David. It's been great to be here.
Well, that's all for this podcast. My producer for this episode was China Collins, and the research was by Sam Bright. If you're a fan of The Briefing Room, you might also like a 5-part BBC podcast series called The New World, which looks at such issues as post-truth politics and the backlash against globalisation and political elites. Just search online for The New World, BBC Radio 4. And if you'd like to let us know what you think about The Briefing Room, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. It'll help other people discover the series. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.